Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. In this final edition of the African American Hour for 2024, all of my readings have to do with end-of-the-year festivities. I'll have selections from History.com, Southern Living, the Chattanooga Times Free Press, the Baylor University Media and Public Relations Department, Parents.com, the Black Agenda Report, and I'm starting with this reading about Kwanzaa from the Independent newspaper. Kwanzaa 2024. What is it and how is it celebrated? It was written by Sabrina Barr and published December 4, 2024, in the British newspaper The Independent. Every year on December 26, the annual commemoration of African American culture, that is Kwanzaa, begins. Observed predominantly in the United States and across nations of the African diaspora in the Americas, people celebrating Kwanzaa honor their African ancestry by exchanging presents and enjoying a large feast with loved ones. While Kwanzaa occurs around the time of other festive holidays such as Christmas and Hanukkah, it isn't associated with a religion. The festival was founded by Malala Karenga, an author and activist who was involved in the Black Power movement in the 1960s and 70s. It was first celebrated just over a half century ago in an effort to instill racial pride and unity within the Black community. Karenga was an activist in the 1960s, co-founding the Black Nationalist US organization in 1965. Kwanzaa is a celebration of community, family, and culture that was established as a way for African Americans to reconnect with their roots and heritage. Karenga explained the significance of the festival while at an event at the Memorial Art Gallery at the University of Rochester in 2013, during which he said, "The celebration of Kwanzaa is about embracing ethical principles and values, so the goodness of the world can be shared and enjoyed by us and everyone." Kwanzaa occurs over the same 7 days every year, from December 26 to January 1st. It lasts 7 days in order to honor the core seven principles of the festival as outlined by Karenga. These seven principles are called Nguzu Saba, otherwise known as the Seven Principles of African Heritage. These principles are Umoja, Unity, Kujichagulia, Self-Determination, Ujima, collective work and responsibility, Ujamaa, cooperative economics, Nia, purpose, Kuuma, creativity, and Imani, faith. The term Kwanzaa comes from the Swahili phrase Matunda ya Kwanzaa, meaning first fruits of the harvest or first fruits. First Fruits festivals are celebrated in December and January in Southern Africa to coincide with the Southern Solstice. Karenga purposely chose for Kwanzaa to have seven letters in its name in order to align with the holiday's seven principles. Families that celebrate Kwanzaa do so in different ways. However, festivities usually involve dancing, singing, gifts, and a large feast. Those observing the festival will often decorate their houses with fruits, a red, black, and green flag, and a kanara, a candle holder that holds seven candles. Three red candles are placed on the left of the kanara, three green candles are placed on the right, and a black candle is placed in the middle. In addition to the kanara, there are several symbolic items associated with Kwanzaa, including muhindi, corn, and a kikomba cha umoja, a unity cup. All of these items are placed on a makeka, or a mat. The festival ends with a feast, or karamu, on the last day. In 2009, author of Kwanzaa, Black Power and the Making of the African American Holiday Tradition, Keith Mays, told the Associated Press that he believes 500,000 to 2 million Americans celebrate Kwanzaa. However, a 2012 study conducted by Public Policy Polling found that 4% of participants said they celebrate Kwanzaa, which therefore means that more than 13 million people in the United States may observe the festival. That was the article, Kwanzaa 2024. What is it and how is it celebrated? It was written by Sabrina Barr and published December 4th, 2024 in the independent newspaper's independent.co.uk website. My next reading about an event that takes place in the Afro-American community this time of year is titled The Meaning of Watch Night. It was written by Sophia Charles and published December 17, 2023 in Southern Living Magazine. The subtitle is A Late Night Tradition in Many African-American Churches Celebrates New Year's Eve and the End of Slavery with Praise, Fellowship, and Hope for the Future. Pastor Agnes Lover remembers the colors and the motions of scarves placed in the pews of Atlanta's Turner Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church. The flashes of orange, red, and gold that sashayed through the air as congregants set them in motion. She recalls the vibrancy in the watch night services she experienced early in her ministry. The inky darkness of the night as cars turned their headlights on the church's parking lot. The pulsing movement as the walls vibrated with erupted tension and ebullient praise. Women and men proclaimed, sang, and shouted captivating and heart-spun testimonies, reflections of joy, adversity, and loss, as the clock approached midnight on the eve of the new year. It was electric, says Lover, who now leads St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church in Montgomery, Alabama. Their spirit was ever so present. The origins of the celebration date back to December 31, 1862, when free and formerly enslaved African Americans across Boston and other cities throughout the North gathered in churches and homes in solidarity with those held in bondage in the South as they awaited news of freedom. President Abraham Lincoln would sign the Emancipation Proclamation into effect on January 1, 1863, marking the beginning of the end of more than two centuries of American slavery. As time has moved further away from the Civil War, the events that took place on Freedom's Eve, 1862, have lost their former centrality to this annual African-American Christian tradition in many churches. In the years immediately following emancipation, formerly enslaved African-Americans gathered at churches on the eve of the new year, evoking the cruel trials of slavery and the sweet respite of freedom as they worshiped together in praise and song. When those who had endured slavery passed on, their children carried their stories. As time went by, many churches began to incorporate a call and response prayer to conclude the service. When the clock approached the midnight hour, congregants implored their minister to mark the time, repeating the call, "Watchman, watchman, please tell me the hour." To which the minister responded, "It's 2 minutes to midnight. It's 1 minute before the new year." Then the clock struck 12 and the minister finally proclaimed, "It's now midnight. Freedom has come." The meaning is still relevant, but it has evolved, Lover says. Now, more or less, people are anticipating the new year. Out with the old and in with the new, and reflecting on the past year. As a pastor, I try to stress how important our faith is to sustain us, because that's what I think Watch Night really means when I consider its heritage as it relates to the African-American community. Lover, who was raised in Alabama, doesn't recall understanding its significance until high school, when she received an award from a local association tasked with preserving the history of emancipation in Montgomery, a city covered with historical emblems. Now the nighttime church celebrations that once yawned past midnight often begin at 7 p.m. and end by 10 p.m. Some churches have combined services while others don't observe Watch Night at all. Yet, in the past 2 years of ongoing political turmoil, disease, and death that have had a marked effect on African-American communities across the country, the significance found in the transformative origins of Freedom's Eve and the testimonial tradition of contemporary church services praising God for carrying one through the trials and tribulations speak to an urgent need to reconnect the services past with the present. I strongly feel that if you're not aware of your history, certain things are doomed to repeat themselves, says Lover. Watch Night is still vitally important for us to come together as a community to watch, to pray, and to really engage in a spiritual way against everything that polarizes our nation. COVID-19's outsized impact on African Americans since the pandemic began in early 2020 is still being felt. A disproportionate number of the more than 700,000 lives lost in the United States to the virus are African American men and women who are hospitalized at almost 3 times the rate of white Americans and remain twice as likely to die from the illness, according to the Center for Disease Control. In July 2021, the unemployment rate for African Americans remained about double that of their white counterparts, according to a Congressional Research Service report released the following month. And Census Bureau data from early September of the same year revealed that about 15% of black adults reported that their households had lacked an adequate food supply within the 7 days that preceded the survey. Maybe black Americans are no longer fighting to free themselves from the chains of slavery, but real threats to their rights as full democratic citizens abound. The 2020 killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and other black victims and the surge of protests that followed cast racial justice again in the spotlight with a unified fervor that many Americans had never before witnessed. In this light, Freedom's Eve serves a reminder of how tenuous freedom, the power to speak or act without restraint, the absence of oppression, the state of not being imprisoned remains for African Americans and other marginalized groups. The struggle continues, says historian Richard Bailey, director of the Emancipation Association of Montgomery. African Americans and all Americans have to realize there's nothing free about freedom. Whatever liberties that people enjoy today, those can be taken away. Throughout history, few institutions have played a greater role in addressing the concerns, priority, and politics of African Americans than the black church. Christianity, as influenced by formerly enslaved worshipers, became a refuge from the intolerance, hatred, and the immorality of slavery and injustice. The church was a site where culture was created, nourished, and protected. Bailey believes that, as marginalized people whose customs and traditions are constantly under threat, black church leadership must always be vigilant in ensuring the communities they foster recognize from whence they came. When Richard Williams, who pastors Metropolitan United Methodist Church in Montgomery, considered the weight of this mission amid the height of the pandemic in the spring of 2020, his church pews, empty of the men and women he had guided each Sunday for the past 2 years, he thought of one word: purpose. Why are we here, and what is this institution's value to our neighbors, thought Williams. We find ourselves in a space where many people are saying the church is needed. If that's the case, what changes are we going to make, and how are we going to lean into our mission? As the news reports they saw were bolstered by personal accounts from church members detailing the disastrous impact of COVID-19 on people throughout their community and the country, he and his congregation sprung into action. William scaled up the church's food bank program and converted the sanctuary into a makeshift warehouse for donated items. He partnered with local health organizations and designated Metropolitan as a COVID testing site. Later, it became a place where community members could get vaccinated. The congregation created a burial program to assist people who had lost loved ones to community violence and couldn't afford the cost of funeral services. For Williams and his flock, the church stepped into its purpose. Nationwide, church membership has steadily declined across denominations since the turn of the 21st century. In 2020, a Gallup poll showed, for the first time in 80 years, that less than half, 47% of all Americans belong to a church, synagogue, or mosque, down from 70% in 1999. The church's role in society, writ large, has clearly changed. Although a greater percentage of black Americans reported that they still belong to a church congregation, 59% in 2020, it represented a 19% drop in attendance since the period between 1998 and 2000. For some, these statistics reinforce the need to recenter the black church's function as a site of aid, power building, and preservation of cultural heritage. Wanda Battle, who attends Union Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in Madison Park, a historically black community founded in 1880 by formerly enslaved people and annexed by Montgomery in 1980, believes this is imperative. The church in our black community has always been a nucleus for social and political activity, and I believe pastors still have that place if they will take it, she says. Battle was raised in Montgomery, but her parents moved the family to Atlanta following the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. She remembers attending December's late-night services at Shaw Temple AME Zion Church as a teenager. After it was over, church members stayed together and ate breakfast until well past 1 a.m. Although she doesn't recall the tradition's connection to emancipation being emphasized in those services, she believes its message is particularly vital. She has a strong desire to adopt Freedom's Eve at Union Chapel, given the community's close ties to the vestiges of slavery. This is the original acknowledgement of our freedom, says Battle. It's a tribute to our ancestors who struggled and overcame so many obstacles and, at the same time, have inspired us to continue to persevere. Every way in which we can keep telling this story, we must. That was the article titled, The Meaning of Watch Night. It was written by Sophia Charles and published December 17, 2023, in Southern Living Magazine. My next reading is about music. It's titled, Black Gospel Music Expert Discusses Timelessness of Christmas Spirituals, Which Differ from Christmas Carols. This was written by Joy Moten, and it was published December 5th, 2017, at the website for the Media and Public Relations Department for Baylor University. That website is news.web.baylor.edu. One of the most cherished parts of entering the holiday season is gathering to sing and listen to Christmas carols. Songs like Silent Night, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and The First Noel resound as Christmas approaches. However, a Baylor University expert in black gospel music holds another Christmas tradition near and dear to his heart. He treasures the rich sounds of Christmas spirituals, which differ from Christmas carols. So many of the spirituals were written in what has been performed as and what scholars call the eternal now, said Robert F. Darden, professor of journalism and founder of Baylor's Black Gospel Music Restoration Project. If you read the lyrics as they were transcribed, many of them are in the present tense. To illustrate his point, Darden referenced the spiritual, Were You There?, in which the lyrics read, It causes me to tremble. Darden said that since slaves in America were not book educated and struggled with the concept of time, the Bible was a contemporary account of what was going on for them. In their minds, they conflated Abraham in the Bible with Father Abraham Lincoln, who was going to free them, and associated Harriet Tubman with Moses and the Ohio River with the River Jordan. Darden said the powerful resonance in these spirituals is unmatched because of the passion of the people who sang them. When you hear the Christmas spirituals, you're hearing people who believe this is a real live event, Darden said. Go tell it on the mountain that Jesus Christ is born, not was born. That gives them more of an immediacy and a power than songs that are in the past tense. Darden listed these 8 Christmas spirituals as some of the most influential songs that help him reflect on the true essence of Christmas. Rise Up, Shepherd, and Follow, from Odetta, Christmas Spirituals. Mary, What You Gonna Call That Pretty Little Baby, featuring Marion Williams and Princess Stewart, from Black Nativity. Sweet Little Jesus Boy, from The Harmonizing Four. Silent Night by The Mighty Clouds of Joy from A Gospel Christmas Celebration. Christmas Hymn by Karen Kraft from The Texas Christmas Selection. Go Tell It on the Mountain by The Mighty Clouds of Joy from The Legendary Groups of Gospel. Joy to the World featuring Marion Williams and Princess Stewart from Black Nativity. Hallelujah Chorus by Pastor Donald Alford and the Progressive Radio Choir from A Gospel Family Christmas. Darden also said that slaves had a more intimate understanding of the nativity story because they identified with the conditions into which Christ was born. They understood what it was like to come from a foreign land to a place where they were despised and enslaved in the way that Christ was born as a refugee child with people seeking to kill him. The spirituals reflect the people who believe they're in the middle of the Bible story. I think that gives them a power that's hard for others to match, and why the gospel artists, who would later record these songs, tried to capture that and keep that immediacy and intimacy that I think a lot of Christmas carols don't have, Darden said. Darden said the modern world still needs Christmas spirituals. While commercialism gets people excited and inspired for the holidays, people in 2017 need something that will help them reflect on what truly matters about the season. They need something that will not only remind them of history, but will also evoke the sensation of gratitude for a needed Savior. By noticing and listening to the words of the spirituals, you see how they focused on what really matters. A child is born under the most desperate of circumstances, despised, Darden said. This season isn't about shopping malls. The season is about remembering that the King chose to be born in the most despised, hated, and vulnerable of times. Darden founded Baylor's Black Gospel Music Restoration Project, BGMRP, more than a decade ago. The BGMRP is the world's largest initiative to identify, acquire, preserve, digitize, and catalog recordings from the Black Gospel music traditions. This music from the Golden Age of Gospel from 1945 to 1975 was quickly vanishing as albums made the transition to CDs. Recordings from the BGMRP are available online in the Baylor Library's digital collection, which includes, in some cases, taped interviews, photographs, press packets, tour books, and programs, newspaper and magazine clippings, and sheet music. The BGMRP also provides the gospel music for the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. That was the article titled, Black Gospel Music Expert Discusses Timelessness of Christmas Spirituals, Which Differ from Christmas Carols. This was written by Joy Moten, and it was published December 5th, 2017, at the website for the Medium Public Relations Department for Baylor University. That website is news.web.baylor.edu. My next reading is from the website history.com. It's titled, What Was Christmas Like for America's Enslaved People? It was written by Farrell Evans and published January 22, 2024. How did Americans living under slavery experience the Christmas holidays? While early accounts from white Southerners after the Civil War often painted an idealized picture of owners' generosity met by grateful workers happily feasting, singing, and dancing, the reality was far more complex. In the 1830s, the large slaveholding states of Alabama, Louisiana, and Arkansas became the first in the United States to declare Christmas a state holiday. It was in these southern states and others during the antebellum period, 1812 to 1861, that many Christmas traditions, giving gifts, singing carols, decorating homes, firmly took hold in American culture. Many enslaved workers got their longest break of the year, typically a handful of days, and some were granted the privilege to travel to see family or get married. Many received gifts from their owners and enjoyed special foods untasted the rest of the year. But while many enslaved people partook in some of these holiday pleasures, Christmas time could be treacherous. According to Robert E. May, a professor of history at Purdue University and author of Yuletide and Dixie, Slavery, Christmas, and Southern Memory, owners' fears of rebellion during the season sometimes led to preemptive shows of harsh discipline. Their buying and selling of workers didn't abate during the holidays, nor did their annual hiring out of enslaved workers, some of whom would be shipped off away from their families on New Year's Day, widely referred to as Heartbreak Day. Still, Christmas afforded enslaved people an annual window of opportunity to challenge the subjugation that shaped their daily lives. Resistance came in many ways, from their assertion of power to give gifts, to expressions of religious and cultural independence, to using the relative looseness of holiday celebrations and time off to plot escapes. For slaveholders, gift-giving connotated power. Christmas gave them the opportunity to express their paternalism and dominance over the people they owned, who almost universally lacked the economic power or means to purchase gifts. Owners often gave their enslaved workers things they withheld throughout the year, like shoes, clothing, and money. According to Texas historian Elizabeth Silverthorne, one slaveholder from that state gave each of his families $25. The children were given sacks of candy and pennies. Christmas Day, we gave out our donations to the servants. They were much pleased and we were saluted on all sides with grins, smiles, and low bows, wrote one Southern planter. In his book, The Battle for Christmas, historian Stephen Nissenbaum recounts how a white overseer considered giving gifts to enslaved workers on Christmas a better source of control than physical violence. "I killed 28 head of beef for the people's Christmas dinner," he said. "I can do more with them in this way than if all the hides of the cattle were made into lashes." Enslaved people rarely made reciprocal gifts to their owners, according to historians Shauna Bingham and Robert E. May. Fleeting displays of economic equality would have controverted the enslaved workers' prescribed role of childlike dependency. Even when they played a common holiday game with their owners, where the first person who could surprise the other by saying, "Christmas gift," received a present, they were not expected to give gifts when they lost. In some instances, enslaved people did reciprocate with gifts to the masters when they lost in the game. On one plantation in the Lowcountry, South Carolina, some enslaved houseworkers gave their owners eggs wrapped in handkerchiefs. Yet, overall, the one-sided nature of gift-giving between the slave owners and those they enslaved reinforced the dynamic of white power and paternalism. For enslaved workers, Christmas time represented a break between the end of harvest season and the start of preparation for the next year of production, a brief sliver of freedom in lives marked by heavy labor and bondage. This time we regarded as our own, by the grace of our masters, and we therefore used or abused it nearly as we pleased, wrote famed writer, orator, and abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who escaped slavery at age 20. Those of us who had families at a distance were generally allowed to spend the whole 6 days between Christmas and New Year's Day in their society. Some used these more relaxed holiday times to run for freedom. In 1848, Ellen and William Craft, an enslaved married couple from Macon, Georgia, used passes from their owners during Christmas time to concoct an elaborate plan to escape by train and steamer to Philadelphia. On Christmas Eve in 1854, Underground Railroad icon Harriet Tubman set out from Philadelphia to Maryland's eastern shore after she had heard her three brothers were going to be sold by their owner the day after Christmas. The owner had given them permission to visit family on Christmas Day, but instead of the brothers meeting with their families for dinner, their sister Harriet led them to freedom in Philadelphia. For enslaved people, resistance during Christmas time didn't always take the form of rebellion or flight in a geographical or physical sense. Often it came in the way they adapted the dominant society's traditions into something of their own, allowing for the purest expression of their humanity and cultural roots. In Wilmington, North Carolina, enslaved people celebrated what they call John Coonering. Other names include John Canu, John Canoss, and John Canoe, where they dressed in wild costumes and went from house to house singing, dancing, and beating rhythms with rib bones, cow horns, and triangles. At every stop, they expected to receive a gift. "Every child rises on Christmas morning to see the John Canoes," remembered writer and abolitionist Harriet Jacobs in her autobiography, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. Without them, Christmas would be shorn of its greatest attraction. These public displays of joy were not universally loved by all whites in Wilmington, but many encouraged the activities. It would really be a source of regret if it were denied to slaves in the intervals between their toils to indulge in mirthful pastimes, said a white antebellum judge named Thomas Ruffin, For historian Sterling Stuckey, author of Slave Culture, the Kunaring reflected deep African roots. Considering the place of religion in West Africa, where dance and song are means of relating to ancestral spirits and to God, the Christmas season was conducive to Africans in America continuing to attach sacred value to John Kunaring. Enslaved people had a long memory of Christmas time. They remembered how they used it to mark time around the planting season. They knew they could count on it for a measure of freedom and relaxation. Their inability to participate fully in gift exchange, one of the most basic aspects of the season, helped reinforce their place as men and women who couldn't benefit from their labor. Some, like Harriet Tubman and the Crafts, saw it as a time best suited to challenge the whole society. The adults remembered the gifts long after their childhoods were stolen by this terrible institution. "Didn't have no Christmas tree," recounted a formerly enslaved man named Beauregard Tennyson in a WPA interview. "But they set up a long pine table in the house, and that plank table was covered with presents, and none of the Negroes was ever forgot on that day." That was the article, "What Was Christmas Like for America's Enslaved People?" It was written by Farrell Evans and published January 22, 2024, at the website history.com. My next reading is an opinion piece about Kwanzaa that looks at the history of the celebration. It's titled, "Why I Don't Do Kwanzaa." It was written by Bruce Dixon and published November 22, 2017, in the Black Agenda Report. "I don't do Kwanzaa. I just don't. I never have. And the very thought of it evokes some difficult memories and feelings for me. It's not the holiday's religious trappings or its Afrocentric fusion of Jewish menorahs, Swahili words, Kemetic Christian, and other rituals. I understand people do have a perfect human right to adopt or make up the cultural and religious practices that suit them. Rastafarianism, Vodun, Santeria, and Kondoble all borrow from multiple traditions, as does Islam from Judaism and Christianity from Judaism, Greek and Roman sources, and so on. So I have no quarrel whatsoever with those who celebrate and find value in Kwanzaa. But for many of us who took part in or were simply aware of the Black Panther Party in the late 60s and early 70s, the Kwanzaa holiday is inseparable from the career and persona of its inventor, Ron Karenga, K-A-R-E-N-G-A, now a tenured professor in California. Back in the day, Karenga headed up an organization called US. As a tool of COINTELPRO, the federal counterintelligence program directed at movement organizations, Karenga's US organization murdered two leading members of the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, Al Prentice Bunchy Carter and John Huggins, and two more in San Diego, Sylvester Bell and John Savage. To my knowledge, Mr. Karenga has never expressed the faintest remorse or regret for these murders or for his part in furthering the nefarious aims of federal and local police agencies in their assault upon the movement of those times. Karenga was later convicted, along with his wife, of kidnapping and torturing two women in his own organization, a crime for which he served 4 years in prison and one in which he still claims to be innocent. Some of Karenga's close and credible associates, however, like former US chair Wesley Kabila, maintained Karenga was not only responsible for those women's torture, but that it was part of an ongoing pattern over the years. "I'm a feminist," Kiulu Nyasha, a former Black Panther in New Haven, Connecticut, told Black Agenda Report. "How can I honor a holiday made up by a man who tortures women in his own organization?" She's got a point. Just now, Spelman College is suspending its Bill and Camille Cosby endowed professorship. Folks are hiding or throwing away their old Bill Cosby albums, and places are covering up the Bill Cosby plaques inside the very buildings built by Cosby money. It's their very imperfect way, if not of sympathizing with Bill's long-hidden victims, of at least disassociating themselves and their works from Cosby's apparent crimes. It's a reasonable precaution. After all, what would we think of charities and institutions who'd taken Cosby's money and loudly celebrated his generosity, but couldn't be bothered with the slightest acknowledgement of his victims. What rankles many of us about the annual hoopla around Kwanzaa, and what should disturb those engaged in building today's movements against injustice and oppression, is that the elderly Mr. Karenga, much like Bill Cosby before his fall, is enjoying an ill-deserved and unrepentant victory lap. To this day, he has utterly evaded any accountability for his part in the murders of Carter, Huggins, Savage, and Bell. For us, what others call Kwanzaa has become a time to remember and celebrate the contributions of the freedom fighters whom Karenga's US organization murdered. I worked with John Huggins. I knew John Huggins personally, continued Kyulu Nyasha. He was a beautiful young brother, only 21 or 22. John left an infant daughter less than a month old. He stood in defense of our people's right to be free. Pretty much everybody knew our apprentice Bunchy Carter. He had a real track record, said former L.A. Panther Harold Welton. Before helping organize the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party, he was known to many as the mayor of Los Angeles and was an accomplished poet and vocal stylist. Earlier, he was part of the Slawsons, a Los Angeles street organization originally formed to defend its neighborhood against local white gangs, one of which was called the Spook Hunters. Influenced by the movement of those times, Bunchy attempted to politicize the Slawsons, splitting off a formation which called themselves Renegade Slawsons before coming into really helping organize the Black Panther Party of Los Angeles. In those times, one of the highest priorities of government was to prevent the street-level, spontaneously formed organizations in every black neighborhood from becoming political. Organizing inroads with this aim were a key reason in why Chicago Panther leader Fred Hampton was targeted and murdered, also by COINTELPRO. But while widely respected by those organizations, Chicago's Fred Hampton was an outsider to the street tribes, appealing to them from the outside. California's Bunchy Carter, on the other hand, was an insider among those tribes, presumably a high-priority target of COINTELPRO. Bunchy was less than 30 years old. Even now, after all these years, if Karenga would come forward and admit what he did and begin in his final years to apologize and ask forgiveness, to somehow begin to atone for the murder and the torture and the other stuff. Harold Welton told Black Agenda Report, "We'd have to begin figuring out how to respond in the right spirit. People do sometimes change and come in from the cold. But he's saving us the trouble. He's arrogant and unrepentant and even looked up to by a generation of young folks who know little or nothing about the man or his history." In his mid or late 70s, the unrepentant Karenga is now celebrated by figures like the establishment's designated Dean of Black History, Henry Louis Gates, who put him up as an authority on the struggles of the 1960s, including the Black Panther Party in one episode of his PBS show, The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. Karenga is regarded as mentor to Temple University's shameless rebating professor, Malifi Asante, who justified his underhanded firing of Philly's Dr. Anthony Monteiro with accusations that Monteiro was a tool of communist apparatchiks. Karenga pens a regular column in the Los Angeles Sentinel in which he absurdly claims his own organization was targeted by COINTELPRO just as the Black Panther Party was, instead of acting as the instrument of COINTELPRO. The way many of us see it, people who celebrate Kwanzaa and are getting something out of it should hold that high. We're happy for them. It's true enough that Kwanzaa is now bigger than the crimes of its founder and will outlive him. But that doesn't mean Karenga's crimes never happened or that they should be forgotten. Someone has to hold high the legacies and the work of John Huggins and Sylvester Bell, of John Savage and of Bunchy Carter. Somebody has to remember who they were, what they lived and served for. Somebody has to recall why they died and at whose hands. While you're celebrating Kwanzaa, some of us will be doing that. That was the opinion piece titled, Why I Don't Do Kwanzaa. It was written by Bruce Dixon and published November 22, 2017, in the Black Agenda Report. Next, I have a humorous opinion piece from Parents Magazine and its Parents.com website. It's titled, Why Black Parents Don't Do Elf on the Shelf. It was written by Tanae Howard and published November 20th, 2023. My halls have been decked since immediately after Halloween, and I'm in constant Santa reminder mode with my kids. It's the most magical time of the year, and this year is the first year in forever that I feel prepared for Christmas. Finally, I won't have to scramble last minute to get everything on my kids' wish list. But no matter how prepared I am for the holiday season, I am never prepared for right after Thanksgiving. You know, when Santa's helpers start making their way back from the North Pole. I have no qualms about admitting that while I love the holiday season, I cannot stand Elf on the Shelf. Elf on the Shelf was created back in 2005, the good old days. The days when people could do things in their homes and the entire world didn't get a play-by-play that would make them feel inferior. But I digress. It took over a dozen years for the fair-skinned, Reed White, blue-eyed elf to get a girl companion, and when she came along, her only noticeable difference were rosier cheeks, some lipstick, and earrings, all of which can be worn by boys too, by the way. Elf on the Shelf didn't seem like it was marketed with black people in mind. It was just 5 years ago that Elf on the Shelf came out with the male and female dark tone doll, and if that's what they came up with for dark, then I can only imagine what my skin tone would be considered in a company lineup. I honestly have no idea if the company is just that uneducated or they just don't care to be inclusive at this point. Either way, I don't care to give them my money. Lack of inclusiveness aside, I'll be the first to say it out loud. The whole premise of the elf is creepy. I am in no way pediophobic. Yes, fear of dolls is an actual thing. But dolls are creepy enough without the whole child surveillance aspect. From Chucky to Talkie Tina from The Twilight Zone and even Annabelle, Hollywood has given us plenty of reasons to remember that dolls coming to life are scary. Why would I then in turn want my child to believe that a doll is watching them in our home and leaving every night to report back to Santa, returning to a new location the next day? That's a horror story in the making, and we already know how well black people fare in horror movies. And coming from growing up in a black and Christian household, we're not about to play with dolls and spirits. It's creepy. Having an elf watching my kids to make sure they're being good, says mom of three, Maria Davis Pierre of West Palm Beach, Florida. I don't care for the backstory that they cannot touch it or that we have to move it daily. We much prefer reindeer in here with a better backstory, and my kids can touch the reindeer. Santa is already supposed to be all-seeing whether you're sleeping or awake. His creepy little helpers can stay in the North Pole. I know a lot of families just see this as a fun thing, but it's worth thinking about the messages it's giving to children about surveillance by authorities, Jay Stanley, senior policy analyst at the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project, told the New York Times. Personally, I consider success as a parent to be teaching my kids to do the right thing even when nobody is watching, whether they be from the North Pole or anywhere else. But I think the general consensus from most of the black parents I know is simple. Ain't nobody got time for that. Between inflation, recovering from pandemic trauma, and a struggling job market, the elf is an unwelcome addition to the already taxing mental load of the holiday season. Carolyn Daly says she doesn't get the point of the tradition. It doesn't seem to have any deeper meaning or connection to the true spirit of Christmas. We already have Santa Claus. As a black mom who works full-time, Daly doesn't want to add more to her plate or compete with other parents about whose elf gets into the best antics. I don't have any time for that. I would rather focus my energy on the memory-making activities, she says. While Elf on the Shelf started as just a Christmas story, Pinterest and social media have made it almost impossible to enjoy the story and just move the elf to different locations in your home. If 1,000 Elf on the Shelf ideas overwhelm you, like it should anyone, then the elf thing just isn't for you. But salute to all the parents who hit the Pinterest aesthetic. As with anything in parenting, Make the choices that work best for your family. As for me and my house, we will remain ELF free. That was the opinion piece, Why Black Parents Don't Do ELF on the Shelf. It was written by Taney Howard and published November 20th, 2023 in Parent Magazine's Parents.com website. Coming up, I have a couple of readings about food. First, Tracing the Origins of a Black American New Year's Ritual. It was written by Kayla Stewart and published December 24, 2021, in the Chattanooga Times Free Press newspaper. The subtitle is, Families Have Long Embraced the Tradition of Eating Black-Eyed Peas and Greens on January 1st, but the inspiration for the ritual crosses cultures and continents. On New Year's Day, Black American families around the country will sit down to eat a variation on green vegetables and cow peas, joining in an enduring tradition meant to usher in opportunity in the year ahead. I don't let a New Year's Day go by without having some form of greens, pork, and black-eyed peas, the food historian Jessica B. Harris said. The choice of greens, usually cooked with pork for flavor, comes from the perception among Black Americans that folded collard greens look like paper money, said Adrian Miller, an author and food scholar. Eating greens on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day is believed to bring about greater financial prosperity. The peas promise good luck, health, and abundance. But while these rituals have become largely associated with the American South, their roots can be traced back to the meeting of West African and European traditions, Mr. Miller said. Collard greens, for instance, originated in Northern Europe. Collards are a corruption of colewort. Colewort is any non-heading cabbage, said Dr. Harris, the author of High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. They became part of the food ways of African Americans. The Africanism is in the cooking of them, not in the green itself. The cooking method of long, low, and slow, with the potlucker being consumed, is a very different thing. And celebrating on the first day of the year is more of a global tradition, Mr. Miller said. In Italy, for example, lentils, said to resemble coins, are cooked down with pork and served for luck. In West Africa, he added, there are certainly auspicious days, but this idea that the first day of the calendar year and doing something on that day would bring good luck, to my knowledge, doesn't exist in West African societies prior to European contact. West African spiritual practices often revolved around deities who had favorite foods like black-eyed peas, which are native to the continent. The forced migration of enslaved Africans to North America and their interactions with European colonists led to a convergence of customs. It's all kind of messy, Mr. Miller said. But you can see this process of cultural diffusion, borrowing, appropriation, all of those things that were happening in previous centuries, to the point where it coalesces into the tradition we have now. Geography also played a role in the variety of interpretations that emerged. In regions of the country influenced by the British, collards or kale might be served on New Year's Day, while in states like Louisiana, where there was a stronger German influence, people often enjoyed cabbage. As white Americans looking to take on a wholly American identity began to reject European customs, black people found ways to transform those customs. When people abandon superstitions because they just seem antiquated, that creates a space for new associations to emerge, Mr. Miller said. Black and Southern traditions eventually became inextricable. The first documented Black New Year's celebration is recounted in Tony Tipton Martin's Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African American Cooking. In the book, she shares the origins of Watch Night, when Black Americans congregate at church for song, praise, and prayer before the stroke of midnight. During the first such event on December 31, 1862, or Freedom's Eve, enslaved people in the South Carolina Low Country gathered in churches to await news of their freedom under the Emancipation Proclamation, which was to be signed on New Year's Day, 1863. Their celebrations included a menu of hoppin' john, collard greens with hog jowls and ribs. My point in publishing these stories in Jubilee was to be able to tell a broader story about African Americans in New Year's Eve, Miss Tipton Martin said. This allows you to see strains of African tradition in things we think about as classic America. The blurring of what Miss Tipton Martin calls good luck food traditions can lead to erasure. Amethyst Ganaway, a Lowcountry chef and writer, notes that people often refer to black-eyed peas and rice and Hoppin' John interchangeably. Both make appearances on Black American tables, but Hoppin' John is a one-pot meal of rice and field peas, a variety of cowpea that's largely available only in the Lowcountry. It is also a bit lighter and redder and has a creamier consistency than its black-eyed cousin. It's important to make that distinction because it's really the origins of those traditions that get lost, Miss Ganaway said. So many people think that Gullah Lowcountry traditions and people are dying off. No, we're here, she added. It actually starts here, and it's important to remember that it starts here for a reason. So our identity, our food ways, aren't being erased and turned into this mainstream thing. Though New Year's culinary traditions persist across the South, Frederick Opie, a professor of history and food ways at Babson College in Massachusetts, noted that they can take on particular significance for African Americans. Is there a correlation between a society or a culture that has experienced a larger than usual sense of being oppressed and marginalized, and that the hope for the next year means possibly experiencing something better? I suspect that there is, he said. How people celebrate the new year is also essential to bringing in goodwill. Dr. Harris hosted parties for nearly two decades in the 1980s and 90s, serving a good luck menu to as many as 70 guests in her Brooklyn home. It was a grand thing to do, and I very much enjoyed it, she said. Black Americans have found celebration in other foods, too. J.J. Johnson, the chef and owner of Field Trip in New York, takes guidance from his grandmother, a North Carolina native, when he prepares her seafood gumbo, with a few alterations on New Year's Eve. I was taught that if you were eating good going into the new year, then you would be good and you will be healthy, Mr. Johnson said. For me, a gumbo like this represents family luxury and joy. Though the menus may vary, the purpose is the same. The tradition has lived on because it's fun, and it speaks to aspiration, Mr. Miller, the food scholar, said. You always hope that no matter what your condition is, that there's always a brighter future. That was the article, Tracing the Origins of a Black American New Year's Ritual. It was written by Kayla Stewart and published December 28, 2021, in the Chattanooga Times Free Press newspaper. My final reading is connected to the food history story I just read. It's a recipe for Hoppin' John. This recipe is from Tony Tipton Martin, and it was adapted by Kayla Stewart, both of whom were mentioned in the previous story. I found this at the website of cooking.newyorktimes.com. Hoppin' John. Ingredients. Yield, 8 servings. 1 pound dried black-eyed peas, picked over for stones, rinsed, soaked in water overnight, and drained. 3/4 of a pound salt pork or bacon, cut into 1/4 inch dice. 1 small onion, chopped. 2 large garlic cloves, minced. 6 cups chicken stock, store-bought or homemade. 1/2 cup diced, 1/4 inch ham, 2.5 ounces. 1/2 teaspoon red pepper flakes. Fine salt and black pepper. 1 cup long grain rice. Preparation. Step 1. Soak the black-eyed peas in cold water overnight. Then drain when ready to cook. Step 2. In a large saucepan, cook the salt pork over medium-high heat, stirring occasionally until crisp and the fat is rendered, about 6 minutes. Add the onion and garlic and cook until translucent, about 3 minutes. Stir in the chicken stock, drained black-eyed peas, ham, red pepper flakes, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon black pepper. Bring to a boil, then reduce the heat, cover, and simmer over medium-low heat, skimming away any foam that rises to the surface until tender, about 1 hour. Step 3. Taste and season with more salt as desired. Stir in the rice. Cover and return the pot to a simmer over high heat. Reduce the heat to maintain a gentle simmer. Cover and cook until the rice is tender, about 20 minutes longer. Remove from the heat and let stand. Covered, 5 minutes. Then serve. That was the recipe for Hoppin' John. The recipe was from Tony Tipton Martin. It was adapted by Kayla Stewart, and it appeared at the website cooking.nytimes.com. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.